Isaiah, the book, is a remarkable book, even from the standpoint of literature. By literature, I'm making reference to quality of writing or smoothness of writing, the style that is in it. And even people who don't believe the Bible, who really don't believe the message, often read from sections of Isaiah simply because it is such beautiful writing, and the way he uses various figures of speech and blends things together just makes it some of the best literature. I'm talking about quality of presentation, some of the best that anybody could ever find anywhere. But we're interested in it because Isaiah was, first of all, an instructive prophet. That is, he spoke to the people of his day and told them in very blunt terms the things that were wrong. He had an influence on kings. He's sometimes called the statesman prophet because he had so much influence in matters of government. But not only did he instruct the people of his time, but he gave prophecies of the future. And we're going in the lesson today to look at some of the very specific things that he prophesied and how they were fulfilled. Of course, most important of all is the fact that he was a messianic prophet, a prophet of the Messiah. And as much as any other book in the entire Old Testament, the book of Isaiah tells us about Jesus. And when you go into the New Testament, you will find references back to things that were in Isaiah showing how they were fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The most well-known case, I guess, would be the reading from the 53rd chapter of Isaiah that the Ethiopian was reading when Philip the evangelist got in the chariot with him. He was reading from what we have broken out as the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. And you remember that when the Ethiopian asked Philip to join him in the chariot and ask him, what did the prophet mean? The text was, he was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and like a lamb dumb before his shear, so opened he not his mouth. In his humiliation, his judgment was taken away. Who shall declare his generation, for his life is taken from the earth? And the text in Acts 8 says that Philip, the evangelist, began at the same scripture and preached unto him Jesus. In other words, his text for preaching about Jesus started back in Isaiah, the 53rd chapter. And that's just one example of how that ties together that way. But now the remarkable prophecies and how they were fulfilled has caused unbelievers to greatly object to the book of Isaiah. Critics who don't want you to believe that the book is what it claims to be, have come up with all kinds of arguments about why it isn't what you think it is. Basically, claiming in some cases that a whole lot of different parts were written by a whole lot of different people wasn't Isaiah at all. And especially the last section of Isaiah, the part that we're especially considering today, they said had to have been written hundreds of years after Isaiah was dead, so Isaiah couldn't have written it. In other words, they say it was somebody else that wrote it hundreds of years later, and that they simply said they were Isaiah. Now, nobody's ever been able to find out who that other person was, but they say there had to be somebody. Now, the reason they say there had to be somebody is because there are things that are so specifically stated as prophecy by Isaiah that are absolutely known to be fulfilled in history. that they say nobody could have written that except somebody who lived at the time that it was fulfilled. Well, you know, there's nothing to a prophecy if you tell the prophecy after it's already happened. That doesn't mean anything. But if you tell it 150 years before it happens, then that's something significant. But that's the reasoning that's made against Isaiah. And most of those critics will say, actually, maybe the first section of Isaiah was written by Isaiah, but the last section, starting with chapter 40 to the end of the chapter, was written by somebody else way later. Now, that always amuses me when I come across that kind of thinking. It reminds me when I was in high school. That was way back. I had a class in Shakespeare, or part of the class was Shakespeare. And I had to write on whether Shakespeare actually wrote what he wrote. Because, you see, there's always been an argument about whether Shakespeare actually wrote his literature. And I wrote a little paper on it, probably got a D on it, don't remember. But I told some of the things people that I found out they'd said, and then I said, I don't think Shakespeare wrote the plays of Shakespeare. Instead, I think it was some other fellow named Shakespeare that lived in the same place. See, that's about the best I can do. Well, I can tell you that Isaiah wrote Isaiah, and the evidence is there. Now, for many, many years, they made this claim that chapters 40 to 66, the last 27 chapters, were written by somebody else a long time after the days of Isaiah. And then in 1947, a few years ago, they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. And some of you may, as I did, have gotten to see the Dead Sea Scrolls on display when they were up in Charlotte. Couldn't read them because I couldn't read ordinary Hebrew, much less that kind of Hebrew, but at least I can say I saw them. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, all of you have heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls. What it is that a number of caves over there in the land of the Bible, I guess the terrain in one area around the Dead Sea is just crevices and caves and so forth. And it started with just a shepherd boy finding a jar of, you know, pottery with some written things in it. And that caused others to come and search a whole lot of others. But anyway, almost at least part of every book of the Old Testament was discovered. And through the scientific analysis that they can date thing, they determine that these books were much older than anything they'd ever found, maybe 200 years older than anything they'd ever found. And in the scrolls, there was an entire copy of Isaiah. Now, some of the books didn't have the whole book, you know, just pieces. But there was almost a perfect, complete copy of the book of Isaiah, which by any kind of reckoning, whether a person was a believer or unbeliever, he'd have to admit that it was 200 or so years before Christ. And, of course, the reasoning is it was already old when it was put in the jar and had been copied over many, many times. And so it had to go way on back in history. So they kind of gave up that thing about it being written later. But anyway, the book of Isaiah is a very interesting book because the first 39 chapters has to do with Isaiah talking to the people who were alive at the time that he lived. And that's, of course, what a prophet would do. And in those first 39 chapters, there are many things that are prophetic, pointing to even to the New Testament. And then the last 27 chapters of Isaiah are referred to often as Second Isaiah. Now, that doesn't mean, as far as we're concerned, that it's a separate book. It's just it has a separate purpose. Now, I don't know how much Frank covered last week on this, and he's not here for me to ask. Since I was away last week, I didn't hear the lesson. But I'm sure he called your attention to the visit of the Babylonians to King Hezekiah in chapter 39. In chapter 39 of Isaiah, after Hezekiah had been recovered from his illness and had 15 years added to his life, the leaders of the government of Babylon, a faraway country, sent emissaries over to congratulate him on his recovery and bring gifts to him. And Hezekiah showed them all the stuff he had. In other words, he did some bragging about what he had. He showed off, which might be a natural thing for a person to do. But Isaiah the prophet came to him and said, "These people that you've been showing this to, that nation is going to come and take everything away from you." Now, that was predicting the Babylonian captivity and destruction of Jerusalem. And that 39th chapter is a key chapter because it just lays out. Now, other passages deal with it too, but it lays out to King Hezekiah, who was basically a good king, don't be proud of these possessions because they're all going to be taken away. And he said, your sons will become servants of the king of Babylon. Now, when that was spoken there in chapter 39, time of Hezekiah, the Babylonian Empire was not very large, and they were not threatening. They were on friendly terms, in fact, with Israel. And so the prediction that was given was kind of startling. It's sort of like somebody coming today and telling us, well, we had some visitors over here from Portugal, and they looked around and time's coming when Portugal's going to invade the United States and take it over. You'd say, what? You don't think about Portugal doing that. That's just not a country that you might think would do that. But that's sort of, just as a comparison, was the way that this came across. And, of course, it was many years before it actually happened, long after the time of Hezekiah. There are a number of other kings along there before the Lord allowed it to happen. And then, after chapter 39, the tone of Isaiah changes. And the opening verses of the 40th chapter gives us the reason that people call those last chapters the Book of Comfort, is because it starts out in the 40th chapter with simply saying, comfort ye, my people. And the purpose of this section from chapter 40 to 66, the purpose was for Isaiah to write things that the people would be able to read and put their confidence in many years after Isaiah himself was gone. He was writing for the people of the future who would be living in Babylonian captivity. Now, the situation that occurred when the Babylonians took them, and there's a good bit in history about how all that took place. There was three different invasions, and by the end of everything, most of the people had been taken over into the other side of the river, and they were in a situation where they were in exile. The temple had been torn down. The city had been destroyed. The land around Jerusalem and all Judea laid waste. There was no cultivation. Briars and weeds were taking over. Wild beasts had moved in because the population was pretty well gone. And it was a desolate land. And the people who lived then over in Babylon, in various parts of the empire, they knew what the situation was. They knew their desolation. And, of course, the feeling would be, we are helpless, we're in despair, there's nothing we could do. One of the Psalms talks about that and says that the people, not the Jews, but the other people would say to the Jews, sing the songs of Zion. In other words, we'd like to hear the kind of music you used to have. And they said, we cannot sing the songs of Zion in a strange land because they had been dispersed. Well, when they did take the book of Isaiah and read the last 40 chapters, they had assurance over and over that God is going to turn this thing around and that you are going back. They also had the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah wrote after the time of Isaiah, closer to the time, but Jeremiah also was very specific about the things that God was going to do. And it's as you read it, there's a lot of poetry. If some translations of the Bible, not the King James, but some of the other translations, will have much of the text of this part of Isaiah put in verse form, like as a poem, not, you know, a simple poem, a lot of symbols, though, used, a lot of comparisons, but we can generally follow what it is if we think through it carefully. And so they would read this, and here they were. Take, just imagine a man. He's a God-fearing Jew, but he's in a desperate situation. And he knows that when he was a little child, his mother picked him up, or his father, and held him, and they walked across some terrible, terrible territory, were marched as captives, and told you're to live here, and you can't go back, and that's all past. And here's this man, and he gets the book of Isaiah, and he gets over to that last section that says, comfort ye my people. And he begins then to study and look at it. And if he is a believer, he's going to come to where he has confidence that God is going to turn it all around. They will go back to Jerusalem. They will rebuild the temple. They will be restored as their own country. And of course, in the history that we have both in and out of the Bible, that's what took place. So it's a remarkable book. Now, I know people don't like to try to keep up with dates and figures, but I just want to call your attention to a few things about this. The prophecy of the captivity is in chapter 39, and it is a time, first of all, when they're on friendly terms with Babylon. Later, Babylon be their enemy, but now they're on friendly terms. And the Medo-Persian Empire doesn't even exist as an empire. They're Medes and they're Persians, but they're not bound as an empire. 92 years after what Isaiah said in chapter 39, that's almost a century, 92 years later, the Babylonians came and completely conquered the land of Judah and took them away captive, destroyed the temple and all. That was 92 years later. And so it was 92 years after Isaiah wrote that that was going to happen. Then, a few years later, the Medes and the Persians became a strong empire. And all of this is known in secular history. If you take world history in college or high school, all of this will be covered. But the Medes and the Persians then became an empire, and they overthrew Babylon. Now, Babylon had conquered and taken away captive the people of Judea. And then the Medes and the Persians took over Babylon and therefore had control of the Jews that were in captivity. But 2 years after Cyrus, king of Babylon, had taken full control, he made a decree that said for the Jews, you can go back to your homeland. You can go back and rebuild the temple. You can rebuild the city of Jerusalem. You will be restored. Now, the thing that I didn't try to give you a lot of dates. I wrote them down, then I said, well, we can't assimilate all those dates together. But if you just keep this round figure in mind, what Isaiah said in chapter 39 of Isaiah is completely fulfilled 150 years later when Cyrus, known as Cyrus the Great, became the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, I want us to look at some of the scriptures that talk about what happened specifically. First of all, if you will look at, well, let me just summarize it this way. Much of what is in Isaiah in this last section is to show the greatness of Jehovah God. Over and over, there are passages that simply extol that God is the only God and recalls what He did. What He did as a creator. And then, excuse me, there is an emphasis in several of the passages on how that God had prophesied things in the past, and now they had come to pass. And He said, can the false gods of Babylon demonstrate that they foretold what was going to happen and then it came to happen? Of course, the answer would be no. And so that prophecy was, that had been given in the past, some of it had already been fulfilled and they had seen it fulfilled. For example, the prophecy of the Babylonian captivity. That was an obvious case of it being fulfilled. But then not only that, he pointed out that while the idol gods, the gods of Babylon, didn't have power to do anything, that Jehovah God could predict things in the future and they would come to pass. Now this theme is repeated over and over, and there's some humor, if you think about it, in many of the passages, in the way, it's a sarcastic humor, in the way that Isaiah ridicules the idols, the false gods of Babylon. See, Babylon thought their gods were powerful because they had won victories. But he points out that an idol is a totally useless thing. And one of my favorite examples of that is how he describes that a man will choose a tree and cut it down, and then he'll cut up part of it to use for firewood, and he'll cook food on it, and then he'll use part of it to carve it into an idol, and then he would bow down and worship the stump of wood. And that's sarcastic ridicule. And it's appropriate because anybody who thinks they can look at a statue that's made out of wood or brass or anything else and think that there's going to be some benefit in praying to a chunk of wood, then that person deserves pity or ridicule or something, that's for sure. But much of this kind of thing is emphasized through the book. But with this, there's this thing that the real God, the only true God, is able to tell you what is going to happen. Remember that the people will first be reading this in the context of their own helplessness as they are in captivity. But the comfort is God is going to turn it around. And now he becomes very specific about how he's going to turn things around. So I'll call your attention to chapter 44, if you will. Look with me at chapter 44, and we'll start with verse 24. Chapter 44 of Isaiah, verse 24 beginning. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am the Lord that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself, that frustrateth the tokens of the liars and maketh diviners mad, that turneth wise men backward and maketh their knowledge foolish, that confirmeth the word of his servant and perform the counsel of his messengers. Now, watch this. That saith to Jerusalem, this is what God says to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah ye shall be built, and I will raise up the decayed places thereof. That saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Now, that's the end of that chapter, but just hold your place right there. There are several things that are worthy of discussion there, but I want you to notice in verse 28, that the name Cyrus is given. Now, this person, Cyrus, is known in secular history as Cyrus the Great. He's one of the most important rulers in the ancient world, as far as his position and power, and there is much known about him. Archaeology has discovered many, many engravings on monuments and so forth about him. And the ancient historians wrote a lot about him. Now, some of what they wrote may or may not be correct, but the point of the thing is that he was an extremely notable person. But now, it says that Cyrus is going to restore Jerusalem. And it goes on down as you start into the next chapter, 45, verse 1, with the same theme. That saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I will give thee treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. And so on. And there's more. I just don't have time to get into all that's in that chapter and some other sections as well that speak of Cyrus by name. Now, it would have been one thing for Isaiah to have said, someday there will be somebody from somewhere who will do these things. And that'd been remarkable right there. But it's not somebody from somewhere. It is a man whose name is going to be Cyrus. And the name is repeated several times. And the point is made, I've called you by name. Now, he says to Cyrus, you don't know me, but I know you. And I know what I'm going to do with you. And, of course, Cyrus conquered all of that part of the world and became the ruler of what's known as the Medo-Persian Empire. And there are incidental things in connection with this that are fascinating. For example, in one place, he is said to have been called from the east, and then he's called from the north. Does he come from the east or does he come from the north? Well, in regard to Babylon, the east would have been Persia, and the north would have been Medo or Media. Well, which was it? He was born in one place, was taken then to grow up in another place, and then came back to the first place. So it was from both east and north as his background. Now, the actual fulfillment of what now, see, this was prophesied. Keep in mind, Isaiah said this, the Lord said it through him, 158 years to be more precise, before it happened. Now, we may guess we can say what we're going to do next week or next month, but it'd be pretty wild for us to talk about what we wanted to accomplish 158 years from now. But the Lord could do it. You see, he sees the end from the beginning. So turn now. Just don't have time to get into all of these things, but we will take the time to turn to the book of 2 Chronicles. I think we'll go to 2 Chronicles, the very last chapter, right at the end of the book of 2 Chronicles. And you should remember that the book of the Chronicles are basically books of history tracing the things that pertain to the various kings, that is, the kings of Judah. But eventually the kings of Judah became so corrupt and the people became so corrupt that God determined to chastise them with the Babylonian captivity. And there's, of course, much in other texts that deal with this as well. But in 2 Chronicles 36, let's pick up at verse 20. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. Now, we've been talking about Isaiah, but Jeremiah spoke of these things too. And here's what he said, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. Now, 70 is 70, and that the land was kept Sabbath meant there was no work in the land in that time. It was a desolate land. And Jeremiah had specifically said, it would be 70 or 70 years. He gave a specific number. Now, in 2 Chronicles, we have recorded the history as it unfolds. And here, this is unfolding. So now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, first year over the Jews, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me, and he hath charged me to build him an house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? The Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. And so there is Cyrus giving the order that it is now time for them to return. Now, if you turn the page in your Bible, you'll come to the book of Ezra. And the book of Ezra starts off by saying almost exactly the same thing that the last of 2 Chronicles said. There's some lines that are identical, and it's all talking about the same thing. Now, one of the really curious things, and I'm not the only one who thought of this. In fact, read several commentaries on this just the last few days. And each one of them said something to the same effect. It says that the Lord stirred up the heart of, or the spirit of Cyrus. That is, got his attention onto this. And some might read that and think, one day he just had a feeling he ought to do that. But that doesn't fit the way that God operates. Instead, remember who was an advisor to King Cyrus. Can you tell me what Jew was an advisor to King Cyrus? I didn't hear. Somebody said something. Daniel. Daniel. Remember the story of Daniel? Daniel overlapped several kings, even to the time of Cyrus. And Daniel was a leading statesman. We might think of him as a cabinet member of the king and advised the king. And while it's not given in detail, many of us who've read this have thought of what it must have been if Daniel took the scroll of Isaiah that we've been looking at today, in this 44th and 45th chapters as we have it, and went to the king. Remember, Daniel is a man who could go to the king. Went to the king and showed him what was written. And the king then said, "The God of heaven has told me." Well, how did he tell him? Told him through the book of Isaiah. Now, Jeremiah's mentioned this connection because the people who were writing this history also knew what had been done by Jeremiah. At least twice in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah is specific that the captivity would last 70 years. Now, that wouldn't be the case generally in history. People who are transplanted in another place and forced to stay there a generation, two or three generations, as could have been the case, with their babies growing up and that's all they ever knew, you wouldn't think they'd ever go back and start all over in their homeland. That wouldn't ordinarily be the thing. But you see, Jeremiah said, in 70 years you will. So, from the beginning of the captivity to the end of it, 70 years. And the Bible is right. You see, you know, sometimes people think, well, the Bible has this and that and the other. No, I say the Bible is right. If you read my opening statement in the last Spiritual Swords, you'll know how plainly I was willing to express my confidence that the Bible is right. It is an authoritative guide. But the bell rang and I'm quitting. Thank you.